Well, baby, you've been on my mind. I think about you all the time. Oh, I wanna see your face. I don't make me wait.
Welcome back, everybody. Sleeping Around the Podcast here in Arizona once again.
Yes, this is my first time in Scottsdale, and it's my first time at a sleep dentistry conference. Yeah.
Wow.
I've been to Phoenix.
Okay.
But never came over to Scottsdale.
And I think people from Scottsdale, Stacey can probably speak to this. You can't really say, they get offended if you call Scottsdale Phoenix. Is that?
Yes.
No? Is that?
I don't live in Scottsdale.
Okay, so fuck Scottsdale. Okay. I'm just kidding. Scottsdale's amazing.
We actually call it Snotsdale.
Okay. I love it here because I love to golf.
Okay.
And
are you coming back next week for the big
Big waste management? I was here a few years ago for that, and it was the craziest thing I've ever attended in my life.
Yeah.
Have you been to it?
A long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was invited to it and I wasn't able to go.
Huh? In the stripper heels?
In the stripper. I don't know if I wore the stripper heels that time.
So anyways, we are here with an amazing guest today.
Because we're here for Transform Dental Sleep. And we have someone who's transformed her dental practice.
She has transformed a lot of people in terms of this. She has been a mentor, a friend, someone I've known for a long time now. I think 2014 when I was just stepping into this.
It's been a long time.
A long time now.
Yeah. Stacey, almost 10 years.
Dr. Stacey Lehman, local product here from Arizona, is with us today. Stacey, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Except I'm a Texas alum.
You are a Texas alum. You are born and bred in Texas.
Houston, and then went to UT, and then Baylor in Dallas.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So how long have you been in Phoenix, though?
22 years.
Okay, but you miss Texas every day, don't you?
No.
Oh, that's right. She's from Houston. Never mind.
No. I love going back, and my whole family is there. My husband's from Dallas, and his entire family is there. So he won't go back. He doesn't like it, but I love going back, but I would never move back. I mean, we just feel like we live in paradise here.
Yeah.
So fantastic. It's a great place to be.
I love it.
How did you enter into sleep dentistry? Because we've highlighted this before, that there's a lot of people who, number one, dabble in it, but not a lot of people who do it full time.
Right. Yeah.
And for me, as a sleep medicine physician, I will say completely ignorant to sleep dentistry prior to working with Matthew and getting to meet with Brandon and really starting to understand, because it's not something that is a part of our regular education.
Right.
It's kind of like, it's this option that no one really has access to because no one really knows what sleep dentist is good to go to.
Yeah.
And so it's like this very like ambiguous box. And I think for the people who may be watching the podcast, they're going, I'm on my wellness journey, right? And how do I know who is qualified to be able to provide me resources that are going to help transform my life?
Great question. And it is a big issue. I think it's getting a lot easier and a lot better. But my journey was, I was actually an RN before I became a dentist.
Okay.
I didn't know
and
that about you.
I was. And I was going to medical school. And thank you, God, for mothers, because my mom told me after I took the MCATs and everything, she said, go check out dentistry. So I thought, because I'm a dental phobe. Last thing I want, I have to be on nitrous to get in the chair. Like, I can't deal with it.
Oh,
I'm
so
a horrible, horrible dental phobe. And so I thought she was crazy. Went in the dental school, took a tour, and I knew immediately that was what I needed to do.
Interesting.
So I went to dental school. So
what
I've
about
been,
it? What about it was like,
I don't know, but it was this moment. Walking through the school, I was just like, I have to do this. It was just a thing. So went to dental school. Because I have the medical side, I've always been a little bit more. So even when I started doing blood pressures in the dental practice, nobody else did.
Sure.
I used to get
You're like, I'm a nurse. I got this.
For real. So I used to take blood pressures. And then when I would discover hypertension, I would send the patient back to their physician. And the physician would say, oh, it was a dentist that took the blood pressure. You're fine. And I would tell them before I even sent them back, make sure your physician knows your dentist was a nurse, so that they because this was before it was all manual blood pressures back in the day. So it's been a journey. Well, so I've always been more on that medical side, and when I saw a magazine ad, and it was I can't remember its name now. That's horrible. But he was giving a course on oral appliance therapy for obstructive sleep apnea, and I was like, oh my God. God, this is perfect. We went to the course, and I immediately, I was, this is it. This is what I have to
do. And prior to this, you'd just been doing general dentistry, cosmetic dentistry.
Never even, I'm going to guess, never even knew. Had no
about
idea.
Sleep apnea or what?
Had no background.
You know what's
with
that. Funny is this is deja vu for me of when Matthew and I had interviewed Gil Suarez from Las Vegas. Same, he was just like, I was kind of burned out. I needed some CE. I went to this conference. I was like, wow, I could do this.
Yeah.
And like, it was the same thing. It just like set a spark. So, I mean, absolutely. If you're a dentist or you're an aspiring dentist, make sure you're going to a sleep conference because that is something that really. I'm hopeful that more people are going to be going, yeah, we need to get into this because I think that, as you've said, there is now this emergence of like, how do we hybridize the practice? Mm-hmm. And it's so funny because the first podcast that we did where we reintroduced Brandon back to it, the title of it was We Don't Stop at the Mouth.
Yeah.
And the reality is that it's so important. Why in medicine we did. We're like, the mouth, really? We don't hear, right?
It's so bizarre. I will say I'm happy about that because as a dentist in dental insurance, it's way nicer than dealing with medical insurance.
Yeah.
It really is. But they've been shielded. I hope someday we'll all collaborate.
And I think we're making strides. You know, you brought up taking blood pressures. Now it's a standard.
It's
every
standard
state, every patient that comes in gets their blood pressure taken. We want to ensure before we do a dental procedure, the ADA is now has their recommendations, their guidelines is that every dentist should at some form or fashion be screening patients for airway disorders. Now, I'm sure the blood pressure thing took a long time for everybody to comply with that.
Mm-hmm. And do
I'm
they?
Sure,
and do they?
And do they? And some do.
Are
and
they
most
supposed to do it every visit? Or
is
only if you're having a procedure done?
In Texas, every visit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, but every state maybe is a little bit different.
Yeah. Because I'm like, I've never had my blood pressure checked.
But for sure, if you're getting ready to get injections, you should have your blood pressure checked.
Right.
I mean,
so like lidocaine.
Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. Never have had my blood pressure checked.
Interesting.
So I wonder if Pennsylvania has a different, New Jersey and Pennsylvania have different laws.
Or maybe you just need a new dentist.
My dentist is phenomenal. I have recently transitioned dentists, and I'll tell you why. Because I went to my dentist to get a new dental device because I have horrible bruxism, right? And
have you been tested?
So I have terrible bruxism, right? It was really more adult emergent bruxism. And I know I'm a gum chewer. I'm also a type A personality. I clench during the day. Even though Gil Levine was just saying, clenching during the day doesn't necessarily predict bruxism. My N of one anecdotal, it did.
Yeah.
but what was so funny is because it had been going on for so long, the thing I didn't appreciate is the fact that it actually eroded my teeth down 4 millimeters.
Mm.
And so when I went in for the new device, his dental hygienist goes, were your teeth always this size? And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, because I didn't realize it. And she's like, because what had happened is that the dental device during COVID, I had lost because I had just had a baby and you're in brain fog all the time. And so I had fallen asleep somewhere and I must have had my dental device in, took it out, and it was under a couch. And it wasn't until we were moving that I found it again. And then my dog ate it. So I finally get it back, but I had a year without it and all the time before I had my initial. And so they're like, can you bring in some pictures before we make you? We just don't want to make you a device. Like, bring in some pictures. And so they brought I brought the pictures in and I start looking at it. I'm like, oh my God, I used to have such a beautiful, what happened? And so instead I had cosmetic dentistry to fix my teeth, right? Yeah. And then they made me my dental device. So then I went to, so I'm a sleep physician. I go to my colleague. I go, I think I might have sleep apnea because this bruxism is terrible and I'm getting Botox in my masseters. So we did the watch pad and not to endorse any specific home sleep testing because I still have a little bit of a controversy of like, do I trust the watch pad algorithm completely? I don't know. But lo and behold, when he did the 4%, no obstructive sleep apnea, my RDI was 0.6. So RDI, respiratory disturbance index, this is measuring how many times an hour do you have a respiratory problem. So 4% means, did I have a desaturation from 100 to 96? It was 0.7. When they changed it to 3%, which is why the American Academy of Sleep Medicine has gone to 3%, because it improves the sensitivity, more likely to identify, my AHI was 7. right? So it went from 0.7 to 7. And so I knew, part of the reason I also knew this, I can't breathe through my nose at all. And the thing that called attention to that for me is the fact of during COVID, I was mandated to always be wearing a mask. And I'm walking around like that. Because I couldn't breathe through my nose in this mask. And so now I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to an ENT and get the nose addressed and then get retested. And if I still have sleep apnea, I'll probably get a dental device because I'm already a Bruxer. It's just, okay, let's figure it out.
Right. Of course. It makes sense. Oh, my gosh. So many people have gone down that same journey. And, you know, it's surprising. What I'll tell my patients, too, is the really severe people, the guys that have it, and I don't mean guys and male, but the guys, the people that have really severe.
Those people,
they're adjusted. They've adjusted to the symptoms and they're not as symptomatic anymore.
Well, let's just be honest about the state of the United States, right? Is that we currently have a sleep epidemic. In 2014, the CDC declared the United States as a major public health crisis because of epidemic proportions. One in five adults at that time were said to probably having a sleep disorder. Now those statistics are going to one in two to one in three adults, increasing risk with comorbidity. Why is it that we have all these people walking around with undiagnosed sleep disorders? It is because we start to accept a lesser version of ourselves,
less quality of life, and not just a sleep disorder potentially. We know that that is major problem undiagnosed, but just like one of the doctors who spoke at the end of the day today was talking about, it's just the fact that a lot of people just aren't sleeping enough. They're not going to bed at a decent time.
Yeah, well, that's a sleep disorder, right? If you look at the International Classification of Sleep Disorders, Edition 3, text revision, that's behaviorally induced insufficient sleep syndrome, right?
But
it's one of the primary drivers of excessive daytime sleepiness.
It's also the problem with primary cares. They don't have enough time.
100%.
They don't have the education. They don't know what to do with these people, and they don't have the time to have these conversations with their patients.
Sure.
And so if they are the quarterback, they don't even address it because instead they just give them a script.
Sure.
Right? And so until we – and there aren't enough sleep physicians. We don't have enough of you guys.
Sure.
So we have to work collaboratively or – these people will never get to that point of treatment. I just don't see how it's possible. So, yes, we need more dentists. We need more sleep physicians. We need more people addressing this epidemic. It's a problem in society, no question.
We already see this divide in sleep medicine of like CPAP, oral appliance, right? Now we're seeing an emergence of additional tiers of treatment for obstructive sleep apnea. And so one is going to be hypoglossal nerve stimulator, which I think it's a great option, especially for people who are non-adherent with CPAP and find that might be a better option, but also because it is a good collaborative with also a dental device. So if I have inadequate treatment from just the dental device or inadequate treatment from just the Inspire or a hypoglossal nerve stimulator, I can use the combination.
Right.
Now, it doesn't stop there, right? So we now are seeing medications like the ApneaMed medication.
Right.
We also are seeing that someone like Eli Lilly is now in a phase 3 trial looking at the GLP-1 agonist. So they have a GLP-1 GIP agonist. And so these are drugs that have been developed. So think of your Wegovys and your Mounjaros and all of those, or your Ozempics, right? Those are now being studied to say, does this treat sleep apnea? Not just does it cause weight loss?
Right.
Does it treat sleep apnea? And so word on the street is that those trials are showing a lot of very, very positive input, which is not a surprise, right? We know that with every 10% of weight loss, you see a significant drop in the AHI, right?
Correct.
Similarly, with every 10% gain, you see a huge increase in the AHI, that apnea hypopnea index. So as people who do sleep dentistry on the sleep medicine side, there's a big concern of, does this threaten the clinical practice of treatment of obstructive sleep apnea? And I don't want to spoil what my opinion is. I want to lead with what your guys' thoughts are of how does this impact business considerations or thought considerations around, does this threaten oral appliance use?
Yeah, I got to say that's a fear-based mentality. I think it's increasing awareness. I think it's getting more patients out there. I think it's getting more patients. You know, everybody's freaking out about Inspire. Oh, Inspire, and this is going to do this and this and da 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 da. First of all, that's a big procedure, but they are marketing the hell out of that, and it is bringing so many more people into the fold to get diagnosed.
Right, sure.
And I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely.
I also know that our devices are not going to treat every patient. They're not going to treat every patient to 100%.
Yes.
And so if we can have some type of medication or some type of procedure or utilization, myofunctional therapy, weight loss, you name it, you know, mm-hmm. from a multidisciplinary approach, then we can take the person that goes from, you know, a 60 AHI to a 12 AHI, and we can add sure. some of those things and get them down to a zero or something like that. So sure. I'm not afraid, but I don't know. You
absolutely.
You're never afraid.
I mean, that's her mantra.
Yeah, no.
Don't be a chicken.
Don't be a chicken, like for real. Yeah. I think that all the awareness has been very beneficial. The CPAP nightmare that's been going on over the last couple of years.
We now are seeing that Respironics is completely folding in terms of the sleep
space. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So thank God we have these dentists out there that can also treat sleep apnea, because, I mean, all these people that were being treated and now they can't even use their machines, mm-hmm. right? So they're something has to happen. We've sure. got to figure this out, because there are people that are suffering every day and we need to do something.
Well, and I think patients need options. You know, one of the things that we talk about and we see a lot, or we have seen a lot, that I'm so happy is starting to change, is there used to not be an option.
Right.
For a lot of patients, they go for sleep apnea in particular, obstructive sleep apnea, they go see their sleep physician, they get diagnosed, they go to a CPAP. Mm-hmm. And it never used to be this conversation. It just was step A, step B, step A, step B, step A, step B.
Right. Well, now they will do that, and then H&S, which blows me away. They still don't even discuss oral appliance.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And H&S and oral appliance therapy is actually a little bit more effective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And H&S is hypoglossal nerve stimulator, for those of you who weren't picking up on the acronyms. Yep. Now, what's interesting, though, is that I think historically, if you look at what is the historical context of sleep medicine and specifically obstructive sleep apnea, that drives a lot of the behaviors we're seeing, right? So sleep medicine is probably the youngest field in medicine, right? Only first developed in the 1970s. And so in the 1980s, the initiation of being able to say, we can actually not have to do tracheostomy to treat obstructive sleep apnea. Before, we're like, yeah, we can diagnose you. Would you like a hole in your throat?
Yeah.
Like, and who's signing up for that, right? And so those are really the patients who were like the obesity hypoventilation patients. So they're so morbidly obese that it causes dysfunction in how your brain is actually able to process a normal, like, blood gases, right, of your oxygen and carbon dioxide and all that, that you actually start triggering inappropriate breathing patterns. Now, when you look at other individuals and kind of the trajectory, we said, okay, wow, we had this influx of everyone coming into sleep medicine in the 80s. And now in the 80s, you have to remember, it was still a period of time where sleep was still an illegitimate field. What do I mean by that? In the 80s, there was still research being done. And so I believe it was Dr. Horn who had published on this about the ongoing optional sleep, right? That consideration. Mm-hmm. And it was actually Dr. Rechtschaffen, who was a part of the initial kind of scoring mechanisms for sleep studies. His lab, they did a series of over a dozen studies in animal models who were the landmark studies demonstrating that sleep was necessary for health and wellness. And those were the studies where they subjected animals to different sleep deprivation. So it was total sleep deprivation, progressive sleep deprivation, and intermittent sleep deprivation. And so what they identified, essentially, long story short, is sleep deprive you completely, you die.
Yep.
If I then do a selective sleep deprivation and restrict certain stages of sleep, I die after a little bit longer. So it was like 2 to 4 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks. And then the last was progressive sleep deprivation. This is what you were referring to earlier of everyone being like, it's 15 minutes here, 30 minutes here. So it was basically subjecting animals models to that. What did they identify there? They identified, and I know your thought is like, they died. Well, yes, but not immediately. What they identified was, first, the animal models went into a temperature dysregulation. So they were unable to regulate their body temperature. They then found that they became hypermetabolic. And so although many of us would be like, that sounds amazing, I eat more and I still lose weight, that is not how our bodies are designed to function. That is actually really bad, because then your body starts to use its own muscle to create energy. And then what happened? They then developed lesions of the skin in the GI system, mouth and the stomach and the intestines, etc. What did that do? It exposed them to infection, overwhelming infection, and they died of sepsis. So These studies basically gave us the foundation of what we now are clearly stating, and even the American Heart Association is clearly stating, like, you cannot compromise on us. This is so critically important because we said if you don't sleep, not only do you die, but if you don't do it regularly enough, you're going to have this horrible slow deterioration and then death. And so what you've now seen is that we in sleep medicine side are coming from this background of, like, we used to not be able to do anything for sleep disorder breathing. Then there became this holy grail of CPAP BiPAPs and ASVs, right? So now I can treat you whether you're obstructive or central. Mm-hmm. And then the studies were mainly done in that. And so what do we start to hang our hats on? We start to hang our hats on, well, we see not only does this treat your OSA, but it starts mitigating all these other things. It starts mitigating your weight. It starts mitigating your cardiovascular. So it creates an insecurity in the medical field to go, I made a pledge to do no harm. If I consider an easier option for the patient, does that mean a better option for the patient? And the reality is that where we are today, sitting here today, is that we now have the literature to start showing that not only are we seeing equivocal outcomes in regards to when you are adhering to a therapy, one, which one do you adhere to better, but then also that it's making those strides that we need to provide that comprehensive improvement. My favorite quote, so in Brazil at World Sleep, I had interviewed Atul Malhotra, and Atul is, I mean, he's the man, right? I mean, you can't get someone who knows obstructive sleep apnea, cardiovascular implications, et cetera, better. And he's very, very funny because he's like straight shooter, like, you know, mm-hmm. whether he likes you or not, or he thinks you're an idiot. And thankfully, he didn't think I was an idiot. But the favorite quote that he had was that he was giving a lecture and he's talking about CPAP and how CPAP is the preferred therapy. And someone raised their hand and goes, is CPAP the preferred therapy for you or for your patient? And he goes, huh. Completely changed his clinical approach.
Uh-huh.
Now when he talks to his patients, he makes sure that he's offering all the different treatment options because he goes, who am I to give you the preferred therapy? And we use the word preferred therapy because we view that still as the gold standard. Mm-hmm. And where we're at now is that we're seeing the tides change.
Yeah, we really
the
are.
Gold standard is what is the person most adherent to. And it's interesting because we're seeing this kind of repeating itself across sleep medicine. In narcolepsy, we're seeing the same thing of people going, well, is this preferred or is that preferred? And we're going, well, whatever the patient is most adherent to is going to make them have better outcomes. So making sure that they can use the therapy and that it's improving the outcome is the most important thing.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I totally agree with you. I think that the tide is turning, which is great for patients.
100%.
That is the bottom line. And it's also great for us.
Yeah.
It's been a long road. I mean, back when we started, there wasn't even a medical code. You know, we've come a long, long way. So I just think that the fact that our patients, there's more awareness, we still have some society kind of things to overcome.
Sure.
That people still believe you can sleep when you're dead. Sure. Right? I mean, it's just unbelievable.
I tell them you'll just get there a lot sooner.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we still have some things to work on, but the fact that sleep has become so much more talked about is just a better thing. This country has just gotten more and more sick.
Yes. Yeah.
And so if we can somehow interrupt that cascade and maybe start turning things around, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, clearly. And I think that we're seeing that there's more and more different options. Not to go back to the GLP-1 agonist, but I mean, this really is such a hot phase right now. Everyone is really utilizing them. And one of the things that I find fascinating about the GLP-1 agonist is because of the fact that, one, not only is there evidence to support that there's improvement in something like obstructive sleep apnea, but we also see data that demonstrates that it implicitly impacts ultradian patterns as well as total sleep time. So how we cycle and sleep, and then also total sleep time, potentially increasing sleep duration.
Yeah.
And some of that may be related to that physiologically, so how our bodies utilize these things that are normally in us, in interaction with orexin. And orexin has so many different roles in regards to body processes. We generally think about orexin as something that's deficient in narcolepsy. However, when it's present, it has a lot of different impacts. So not only is it your main wake-promoting neurotransmitter, but it also is heavily involved in a reward pathway. And so we do see that when we're using the GLP-1s, not only are people changing their eating patterns, but they're drinking less, or if they're smokers, they're smoking less because their reward pathway is being manipulated. Mm-hmm. What's fascinating is that we're also going to see this future landscape, because we currently see over a dozen companies making orexin 2 agonists, orexin 2 receptor agonists. And so I think in future state, we're going to see some of these medications being combined to be able to really optimize the sleep landscape in a way that we've never seen before. All of this is going to further drive the awareness. We recognize in the United States, 75% of adults are overweight or obese. 50% of our children are overweight or obese. And the staggering thing, if you're not aware of this, is that we can predict obesity by the age of 6 months of age. Yeah. So the child who is overweight at 6 months, and it sounds horrible to say, right? Is going to be more likely to be overweight or obese, not only as an older child, but also as an adult. So we're our own self-fulfilling prophecies. And so it does become really important for us to have this call of attention of how do we optimize all of the factors, and sleep is a main mitigating factor across all wellness initiatives.
Absolutely. Well, we just have to all work together and make sure that we change that future, you know, somehow.
Yeah. So I think that really what we're saying is that we need to continue to keep it between sleep friends. We need to expand our circle of sleep friends. Yeah, we're glad that you're our sleep friend. And of course, Stacey, we're so glad that you're our sleep friend, came on to Sleeping Around the Podcast with us. And as always, make sure you're liking, subscribing, sharing, and tuning in, because we're going to continue to just keep it between sleep friends.